Lynn Turner.
That was helpful, Dan. As a member of the ACAP, it was I found it very useful to understand your thoughts on all that. One of the issues in ACAP was the issue of the firms filing the annual report, including the annual financial statements. And in light of what we've seen go on in the markets in the last couple years, where there's been severe criticism of some of the agencies for not being on top of the capital and liquidity and leverage that were in some of the firms. We saw Greenspan yesterday testify about some of that before the FCIC, noting that the regulators had totally missed the boat on that. Do you have any fear of that same criticism falling on the PCAOB? Because as I understand it, you in fact are not getting financial data on that type of information.
Well, I suppose the way you phrase the question, the answer is yes. I mean, if one of the large firms were to fail, I think we would certainly be held accountable for what we knew and when we knew it, and whether there's anything that we could have done or should have done to prevent that. As I've indicated, and this certainly isn't a recommendation that we've rejected or we've made a decision not to implement, but we have not yet taken any action on it. I guess my own feeling is that in terms of anticipating whether one of the large firms is likely to fail, I'm not sure the financial statements would be the best way of getting at that. I think it's probably more the kind of information we get now about the various claims that are pending against them, and maybe something far beyond the kind of information we're getting internally now. Financial statements might bear on that to some extent, although financial statements, you know, in their nature are issued annually. They're not updated constantly, and my sense is that these kinds of crises are more likely to occur in such a rapid fashion that the financial statements might not be the main tool for learning about them. But I take your point. I don't disagree with your point.
Damon Silvers.
Well, Dan, I mean, you and I worked together on some of these things, and I thought it was a great pleasure to do so. I want to commend you for how much progress you've made on so many of these items. I think you alluded to this in perhaps less blunt language than I'm going to. The ones that where there's been less progress are obviously the more politically loaded ones. I think that, as you said, I mean, there's a certain amount of uncertainty associated with the composition and functioning of the board at the moment. There's some basis on which to sort of think that maybe the heavy lifts should wait for more lifters. I do want to encourage you on the notion that maybe it's best to move ahead here with some of this stuff, some of the harder things now. And we've discussed some of these items here at great length, including some of them yesterday. I think the passage of time has not dulled or undone the rationales for those recommendations. And it's probably time to move forward. But I did want to express my appreciation as a participant in that process for how much has been done.
Thanks, Damon. I appreciate those comments.
Kurt Schaap.
Very quickly, thank you, Dan, for the update. On a little bit different topic, there's all sorts of legislative wranglings about what's going to happen with SOX 404B for small issuers, and it still seems to be in legislative limbo. And the question I have is, should this board be taking a position on that? And if not, why not, I guess, is my question.
Well, I'm not quite sure how to answer that. I don't think this board was originally conceived as a group to take public positions on policy issues. was more conceived as a group to give advice to the PCAOB. I think, and from my personal perspective, Mary Shapiro has made a strong statement in opposition to exempting smaller public companies from Section 404. And given the SEC's oversight of us, that's I think that kind of answers the question in terms of our position.
Jeff Mahoney.
Thank you. Just wanted to thank you for the update. As you know, this was a major undertaking in developing this report, and unlike a number of other committees that have been set up on other issues here in Washington, this truly was a balanced committee with representatives from the investor, business, academic communities. And I, as Damon said, I appreciate the efforts you've made to move these forward, and I hope you'll continue to do so and that you'll continue to update us on the status of your activities. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff. I guess I didn't neglect to mention that, but I, at least for myself, I would view this as something that we would do periodically as developments change.
Well, thank you very much for your questions and comments on the advisory committee recommendations. Dan, unless you have any other further comments, I'll move to the next agenda item.
No, nothing else. Thanks, Marty.
Okay, thank you. Well, the final item on our agenda as we move towards a close. As I mentioned, the proposed and then reproposed standards on the auditor's identification of risk and the auditor's assessment and response to that risk, and these risk assessment standards that go right from planning and supervision right through collecting of audit evidence, I think are critical standards, foundational in their nature to where our future standard setting goes. Keith Wilson has been leading the project on the risk assessment standards. As I mentioned, the comment period closed on March 2nd. Keith is working closely with the rest of the staff and with me, moving towards a final proposal of final issuance of those standards with a target for the third quarter. Keith, I've asked Keith to give an update on the comments that were received as part of the reproposal.
Thank you, Marty. As he mentioned, my objective here is to brief you on the comments that we've received so on the proposal. We're still in the process of analyzing them, so we don't have formal conclusions or recommendations to the board at this time, but we wanted to try and give you a bit of a sense of some of the comments that we've received. I also should preface my remarks by saying that I realize that some of you around this table may have actually participated in drafting comment letters and providing those comments to us. The natural part of this process is we have to winnow some of them for this presentation, so you may not see every comment that you have had placed in a comment letter, but please rest assured that we are carefully looking at each and every comment, and we'll plan to make an appropriate response to those. Before I actually get into the individual slides, let me just quickly, for those who haven't been following this project as closely, give you just a quick overview of the standards themselves, what's involved in this suite of seven, as some have called it, and then we'll move right into comments. The first standard is standard on audit risk, which describes in general terms the components of audit risk and the auditor's consideration of audit risk, in both from the assessment and the developing procedures to respond to risk. Audit planning and supervision, and the second standard, as the name implies, it describes the auditor's responsibilities for planning the audit and for supervising engagement team members. And that would include things like deciding which matters are important to audit planning and setting an appropriate audit strategy and plan. The third standard, called consideration of materiality in planning and performing an audit, describes the auditor's responsibilities for applying the established concepts of materiality in planning the audit and performing audit procedures and determining, in effect, the scope of the audit. The standard identifying and assessing risks of material misstatement describes the auditor's responsibilities for performing procedures to identify and assess the risks of material misstatement. And the companion standard to that, the auditor's responses to the risks of material misstatement, describes the responsibilities for developing overall responses to the way the engagement is conducted, as well as developing specific procedures to respond to the risks that have been identified. Evaluating audit results is a standard that describes the process, the auditor's responsibilities for evaluating the evidence that they've obtained during the audit and determining whether or not they've obtained sufficient appropriate evidence to support their conclusions expressed in the auditor's report. And finally, the standard on audit evidence talks more about the sufficiency, what sufficiency and appropriateness of audit evidence means, and what procedures the auditor might perform to obtain that evidence. All right. This time we have we've received 23 comment letters, down somewhat from the prior year. The profile here, as we've described, there are 10 from auditing firms. There are we received 6 comment letters from what I call associations of accountants or firms. So that would be like state societies, 3 international associations of accountants, and the Center for Audit Quality. The academics, one of those commenters in the academic column is the Auditing Standards Committee of the American Accounting Association, and then there was an individual academic. In the last category, other, includes CalPERS, the Institute of Internal Auditors, the GAO, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and an individual who's apparently a consultant. Just as a general observation, I would say that most of the commenters did acknowledge and recognize that there were improvements in the reproposed standards as compared to the original standards, and I say that for 2 reasons. It was, in some cases, the commenters specifically acknowledged improvements, supported some of the changes that we'd made affirmatively, and also there was a substantial reduction in the number of comments in these to the reproposal as compared to the original proposal. In general, the themes that we saw in the comment letters were substantially the same as the comments that we received on the original proposal, but the specific comments may have changed. So, for example, one of the key objectives of this project, we were as has been said, was to try and create better alignment between the standards for assessing and responding to risk and the board standard for auditing internal control over financial reporting, AS5. And there were a number of comments on the original proposal about suggesting ways to improve the alignment, and we made a number of changes in that area for the reproposal. The commenters seemed to, some of them specifically supported those changes that we made in that area, and we really had a substantial reduction in the number of comments. I think we had one commenter who suggested a number of amendments to AS5 in light of the reproposed risk assessment standards, but generally there seemed to be an acknowledgement that there is good alignment between the standards now. We did have a number of commenters who continued to make statements about supporting reducing unnecessary differences with the standards of the IAASB and the ASB. Some used words like converge, others align. Some said reducing unnecessary differences, but all in that same sort of vein. And one area that we received quite a bit of comment, maybe the largest single area, in fact, was asking more information, asking for more information, more explanation about how these reproposed standards would affect audits. What were we expecting auditors to change, and what's the board's rationale? Just more information about those kinds of questions. The comments varied in terms of the types of specific information they wanted, the form of the information that they were looking for, but certainly that's an area that's going to require a lot of thinking and study on our part in terms of coming up with a way to more effectively describe the changes that we would expect these standards to have on audits. We did have some commenters that acknowledged that some changes that the board had made in the standard setting process and efforts to improve transparency, such as having a concept release or, in this case, a second proposal of the standards. So some of those and just some general observations about things that we've done in terms of publishing our agenda and keeping updated on that. There were a host of other recommendations on improving the standard setting process in general. Probably the most common one was a recurring suggestion to use external task forces in the process of drafting standards, and various comments along those lines. There were, as has been mentioned a couple of times already, one of the big areas of focus in this project was to try and integrate the requirements for the auditor to assess and respond to fraud risk as part of this risk assessment standards. And we, on the original proposal, we received a number of comments about this. They were quite mixed. Some were very supportive, some had concerns, some were neutral. We had fewer comments this time, but we continued to receive some comments about that. And again, it's mixed. Some support it quite strongly. Some are more concerned about that approach. And we did have, I think has been mentioned at least a little bit, one of the important points of emphasis in the re-proposal as compared to the original proposal is a number of new requirements related to that are intended to focus the auditor on the area of disclosures. And so in some of the standards, there are requirements for, as part of obtaining an understanding of the company and the environment, to develop expectations, I'll say, of the types of disclosures that they'd expect to see in the financial statements. In terms of thinking about assessing risk or brainstorming about fraud risk, to think about ways that the financial statements might be misstated by omitting disclosures or providing incomplete disclosures. And then a more focused discussion in the standard on evaluating the financial statements, more discussion about specifically evaluating the disclosures in the financial statements. Commenters generally supported the new requirements. We did get some specific comments for requests for clarification about these the specific requirements we had, and I'll discuss those as we get into the particular standards. But I think generally commenters seem to be supportive of those additional requirements. Turning to specific standards, the audit risk standard, as I mentioned, it describes the individual components of audit risk, the risk that the financial the auditor would issue an inappropriate opinion when the financial statements are materially misstated. And we had some requests in the comments for some additional discussion about some of the points that we had covered in there. For example, when we talked about risk at the financial statement level, they wanted more discussion about how those kinds of risks would result in misstatement of the financial statement. So, for example, if there was a decline in the company's industry, how would that potentially result in material misstatement of the financial statements? They wanted the standard to talk about that more, and also to talk a little bit more about some of the points about how the auditor considers risk and develops procedures to respond to risk. The planning and supervision standard as the name suggests, and as the interim, like the interim standard it would replace, covers both audit planning and supervision. And we received comments that along the lines of these are, in fact, separate topics. They may have some relationship, but they're really separate topics, so they ought to be in separate standards. So if we follow those recommendations, I guess we would end up with a suite of 8 standards instead of a suite of 7 standards. There were some comments about the role of the engagement partner and the responsibilities in here. And I guess by way of background, the standard starts off early on by saying that the engagement partner is responsible for the engagement and its performance, and therefore they're responsible for planning and supervision, but they may seek assistance from other engagement team members. From that point, following in the standard, we use the word auditor in the standard to encompass both the engagement partner and others who are involved in the process. And there were some requests to lay out in the standard the linkage between the engagement partner and auditor responsibilities as we describe it in the standard. One area that was a significant area of change relates to the scoping for multi-location engagements, and that refers to how the auditor determines how much work to do at individual locations when there's a multi-location engagement. We had a number of commenters on the original proposal that essentially said you should align these requirements more closely with AS5 and you should make them more risk-based. So we did that, and there seemed to be support for that, but there were a couple of points that they wanted to that commenters called our attention to. One is there's a specific requirement in the standard for varying the procedures at locations from year to year. That requirement parallels a similar requirement in AS5. And commenters suggested that that was too prescriptive. It was unnecessary because we do have another standard that more generally requires the auditor to incorporate an element of unpredictability. And they were suggesting that this specific requirement could be made an example of the more general requirement in our standard. There were also specific requests, going back to a topic that we covered, that we talked about yesterday, how would the requirements we have for scoping multi-location engagements apply when there's another auditor involved? And specifically when there's divided reporting responsibility kinds of situations. So a request for at least an explanation, if not some kind of modified provisions to address those situations. Another area that we made a significant change in the reproposal versus the original proposal is in the area of considering the need for persons with specialized skill or knowledge. The original proposal had said that it required the auditor to consider, as part of planning, whether or not they needed a person with specialized skill or knowledge in order to effectively conduct the audit, in essence. And there was also a requirement in there related to the knowledge that the core audit team needed of the subject matter in order to effectively deal with the person with specialized knowledge or skill. Some of the original requirements were framed in terms of IT specialists because that was what our existing standard frames the requirement. We had a lot of comments to the original proposal that said broaden it to include anyone with specialized skill or knowledge, and we did that. And so we seemed to get support for that change. They did have, and there were a couple of drafting suggestions for it, but commenters also took the opportunity to provide some of their views on when a specialist should be under the general requirements for supervision versus when they should be under a separate standard for using an auditor specialist. So some of those, we're going to analyze those comments. Some of them may be more applicable to the separate specialist project, and if they don't get picked up and addressed in, as part of this project, certainly they would be something we would consider in the follow-on specialist project. On the standard on materiality, there were three significant changes to that, to the reproposal, which sparked comments. The first was a change in the articulation of the concept of materiality. In the original proposal, we had used a quotation that existed in our existing interim standard that is from a FASB concept statement number 2 that described materiality, and we had a footnote that referenced the applicable interpretation of the federal courts in interpreting the securities, federal securities laws. And during the intervening time between the original proposal and the reproposal, of course, the FASB released its codification, which, as you know, doesn't include the concept statements. So that caused us to pause and reflect on this discussion, and what we came back to was actually the standard that does apply in these situations, which is the standard that's articulated by the courts. So our standard now says, now uses the articulation from the federal court decision that states a fact is material if there's substantial likelihood that the fact would have been viewed by the reasonable investor as having significantly altered the total mix of information made available. So in a reproposal, that's the articulation that we used, and it because it is, in fact, the standard, as I mentioned, that's used, and it does also make clear that the concept of materiality that applies here should reflect the perspective of a reasonable investor. And comments on this area ranged from some requests for some additional discussion about how this concept is applied in an accounting sense to some actual just concerns about using a court language from the federal courts in an auditing standard. Another area that drew some comment, we included another sentence in the standard. The standard requires that when planning the auditor should establish a materiality level for the financial statements that's appropriate in light of the particular circumstances. And we'd added a statement that said that this includes consideration of the company's earnings and other relevant factors. That was really intended to be just an acknowledgement of the fact that typically for these kinds of companies, earnings is the most significant factor. But we did have some commenters asking questions along the lines of, well, does that mean you always have to use earnings? Is that required universally in each case? Is our intention, what did we mean by other relevant factors? So really that's more asking for, I would say, clarification on that point. Then another area that was a change in the reproposal was we added specific provisions related to determining materiality in multi-location audits at the individual component level. So determining the materiality at an individual business unit or location. And there was a general principle articulated and then requirement to say that the materiality at that individual location or component level cannot exceed and generally should be less than materiality for the financial statements as a whole. And we received some generally favorable comments for adding this requirement, but there were some requests, again, for specific additional clarification on, for example, how you would apply this, again, in a divided reporting scenario when there was another auditor involved. In the identifying and assessing risks of material misstatement standard, we have continued to receive comments on a requirement to consider performing additional procedures, which involve things such as reading public information about the company, such as analyst reports, reading transcripts of earnings calls, obtaining information about trading activity in the company's securities by significant holders to identify potentially significant unusual developments. And most of the comments in this area are really around scope. What are the expectations? Do we expect auditors to go out and track down every single piece of publicly available information about the company and affirmatively document that and check off do we intend for them to look at it or not? So this is another example of trying to provide some requests for clarification about what the expectation of performance is. Then for the areas where the requirements that I mentioned about obtaining an understanding about necessary financial statement disclosures and some of those requirements, the commenters asked us to be sure to clarify that we're talking about evaluating disclosures in the context of the applicable financial reporting framework. And there was, in the area of obtaining an understanding of internal control over financial reporting, we have, in order to determine how the extent of the understanding that's needed, the standard outlines certain objectives that the auditor needs to meet overall. And that's supposed to guide the auditor through the process of determining for each component of internal control how much information that they need. There's still some, in the area of when we get down to control activities, there's some concern about whether or not what our expectations are in terms of how much understanding of control activities there are. Are we intending the auditor to look at all control activities, or are we really intending there to be a significant change in practice related to that? So, again, a request for clarification on that point. And then finally, on this standard, we have a requirement which really is carried forward from our existing requirements for the auditor to consider information obtained from other engagements. And that information, we had two types of comments on that requirement.
It's other engagements for the
Yes, other issuer. Engagements for the company. Yes. And they some people felt like this was too broad, and there were suggestions to either go back and use some additional language that's in our existing requirement or to alternatively frame this in terms of the engagements performed by the engagement partner as opposed to by the firm. So that would, in fact, if we went to engagement partner, that would, in fact, be a change from our existing standards and our existing requirement. For the auditor's response standard, there are requirements. We spent a good bit of time here in trying to frame the auditor's responsibilities around using information from prior audits in the evaluation of the effectiveness of controls. And we have, like in some respects AS5, that this standard requires the auditor to obtain evidence each year about controls that they're going to rely on. But it does allow the auditor to use evidence from prior year and information about risk in determining how much additional information they need in the current year. And so we had comments on this requesting that we add some additional language to make clear that this could be that the information from prior year can inform the auditor's risk assessments, which in turn drives the extent of evidence needed in the current year. And in the area of we have requirements related to situations in which the auditor performs substantive testing at year end, at an interim date. For example, in a calendar year end audit, they might test accounts receivable at October 31. And we have requirements that really are adapted from our existing requirements about going and updating the auditor's conclusions from that interim date to year end. And what the standard requires the auditor to perform procedures to cover the remaining period that would provide a reasonable basis for extending those conclusions. And then we have some specific procedural requirements that need to be included as part of that work, which, again, are carried forward from our existing standard. It was we did get comments, and some of the commenters indicated that those specific additional requirements weren't necessary and that we should just go with the more general requirement about performing procedures that provide a reasonable basis. In the evaluating audit results standard, we had our reproposed standard requires the auditor to accumulate misstatements that they find other than those that are essentially de minimis, and if they're uncorrected, to communicate those to management, and if management does not correct them, to evaluate the reasons why as part of their assessment of bias. There were some commenters asked us to also include a specific requirement for the auditor to request management to correct the uncorrected misstatements. And we received that comment on the initial proposal. Our reaction was that there are already existing requirements for management to do that, that it was unnecessary for us to put in an auditing standard to specifically require the auditor to ask management to correct those. But we nevertheless received additional comments that we should have such a requirement in the standard. We have a requirement, another area, we have a requirement in the area of evaluating uncorrected misstatements. We have an existing requirement to, and carried forward in these standards, to evaluate the effects of uncorrected misstatements detected in prior years and misstatements detected in the current year that relate to prior years as part of the overall evaluation of uncorrected misstatements. And some commenters wanted us to include a specific cross-reference to SEC Staff Accounting Bulletin Number 108 on the subject of considering the effects of prior year misstatements. So a number of commenters suggested that we add that reference. Then the last point on this in this area was a recommendation, again, as I mentioned, that we have specific additional requirements for evaluating disclosures as part of the evaluating the presentation of the financial statements, and specifically evaluating whether the financial statements include all the required disclosures. And we had some commenters that requested that we be sure and make a qualification of this requirement based on materiality. The audit evidence standard, there were requests for additional explanation about what sufficiency and appropriateness of audit evidence means. And some said create some specific definitions of sufficiency and appropriateness to include as part of the standard. Another said that sometimes in our standards we use the word persuasive or persuasiveness. Please provide an explanation of how persuasiveness relates to sufficiency and appropriateness. So we received those kinds of comments. In the area of amendments to PCAOB standards, the reproposal included some specific additional documentation requirements that weren't in the original proposal. Some of them related to things such as documenting the risk assessment procedures and the responses to the risks, including a summary of identified risks, the auditor's assessment of the risks at the financial statement and assertion levels, and the auditor's responses showing the linkage between the risk assessments and the responses. And we had a couple commenters that said that this requirement itself was too prescriptive. Others just questioned whether we should be, we had proposed this as an amendment to AS3. Some had suggested that it actually was more appropriate to put these kind of documentation requirements in the respective standards. And finally, in the area of, in our, we had proposed an amendment to the audit sampling standard, and it relates to sample sizes when an auditor is using non-statistical sampling methods. And the requirement would say that when a non-statistical sampling method is applied properly, the resulting sample size ordinarily will be comparable to or larger than the sample size resulting from an efficient and effectively designed statistical sample. We explained in the release that the intent is not that you calculate a statistical sample size and a non-statistical sample size. The idea is that recognizing that a number of firms already have methodologies to accomplish this that were derived from statistical sampling methods, that they could just use those. And the idea was to point to that as opposed to just saying I'll pick three because based on my professional judgment, was to put some more rigor around the process of considering what an appropriate sample size was. We had requests to put in some qualifiers to specifically say in the standard that we are not intending for auditors to calculate sample sizes under both methods. So that concludes my remarks on the comments that we've received so far, and I suppose we have a couple minutes if anyone has questions or comments, wants to react to that. Doug Carmichael?
Just a quick comment. And I, whenever I bring this up, people always say, well, it's not a problem because management today is correcting all the misstatements that the auditor proposes anyway. But I think it would be a good idea to reinforce the point from the Sarbanes-Oxley Act that management is required to correct all material adjustments that the auditor proposes. Just to remind people of that.
That's a good point. Thanks.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Keith. Thanks for that summary. We did that because, as I've said on numerous occasions, I think these seven standards are very important for the performance and execution of an audit. And they are adding to the framework that already exists under the PCAOB standards and will be foundational for future standard setting. Our goal, as I mentioned earlier, and it is a goal, it's a lot of work here, is to try to address all of these comments and try to issue these standards during the third quarter. Well, this brings to a close, from my perspective, day and a half of very productive discussions and contributions on the part of the SAG members to things we're doing in setting standards at the PCAOB. I appreciate the engagement that I saw here with respect to the various topics we had and the valuable input that you gave us along the way. Before I continue the close, I just wanted to open the floor one more time to see, at a great risk, to see to see if there was anything that was left unsaid that some felt they wanted to say at this point in time.
Marty.
Professor Cox?
Yeah, I just wanted to return to a question that came up about 404B and what the role of the PCAOB should be with that. And I don't want to engage the question about whether the position taken by Dan was correct or not. I would just want to offer a somewhat different approach. And that is, and something you and I talked about a year ago, Marty, is that this organization carries out inspections and gains a lot of experience and not only informs the standards that get drafted, but I think it can also inform greatly the public debate. So to the extent that you've been carrying out inspections for a number of years now over a timeline, it may well be, and I would hope that you would be keeping track of this, that we pay attention to a lot of different things and gather the data. And it would be relevant to the debate to find out whether there's anything dramatically that's happened with respect to the quality of internal controls of the companies that you carry out inspections of, the working papers, that their audits, that we can generalize about in a non-neutral, pardon me, in a totally neutral fashion, non-political fashion, that would inform the debate about the appropriateness of carving out the non-accelerated filers. I think that would be terrifically useful if you have that data. The data will be very simple. Observations have been made about internal controls between accelerated and non-accelerated filers of the inspections you've carried out and how that's changed over some period of time. That doesn't get you into a debate about what should happen on the Hill. I think it's totally appropriate to do. And quite frankly, if you don't have that data in front of you, as you move forward, you ought to think about it, because I think that's one of the roles that this organization can perform. I attended those hearings on the future of the accounting profession and heard the panel talking about accounting education. And one of the issues they were talking about was the absolute dearth of information about what there is on the ground in terms of audit compliance and experiences, et cetera. You're on the front line of that. I think you could step forward and perform a terrifically public mission without tarnishing your image as being a standard setter without a political dog in this fight as such.
Thank you for that comment, and we'll take that into our advisement. Galen?
If I could just follow up on that, and I really appreciate those remarks, Professor Cox. You know, keeping the idea of neutrality, you know, and I'm a representative. I'm from a small firm, but I'm getting a lot of questions right now on 404B. And without getting into the right or wrong in the mix, but, I mean, something really ought to be said to the firms as well as this small companies as to what's expected of them. They've seen this extended so many times. And I know Mary Shapiro's has gone on record as saying, well, this is the end of it, but there's this whole thing with the legislation of the Reform Act, and I really think that some sort of public announcement, just sort of reemphasizing what's expected, because there's a lot of confusion out there right now on this particular point, and I think it would be helpful.
Thanks, Galen. Don't want to put anybody on the spot, but any reaction at that end of the table?
The chairman's made a statement. That's the statement. I think it's fairly clear. I have nothing to add to her comments.
Thanks, Galen. When I took over this responsibility, I contacted the SAG members and asked for input regarding the operation of the SAG, content of things that were covered at SAG meetings, things that worked and things where you all thought we could improve and make the SAG work better. Hopefully we responded to those comments. But to the extent you all feel that there are further things that we can do to improve the operation of this group, we sit here with the benefit of a lot of great people sitting around this table, and we want to maximize the benefit we get out of these meetings. So between this meeting and the next time we get together, certainly feel free to contact me via any form or other board members as well on anything you think we should be doing better to make the standing advisory group even be more effective than it is right now. And I do find it, from my perspective, to be very effective. So please call, phone, email, or whatever, and be glad to take your recommendations. With that, the next meeting is scheduled for July 15th. It's planned to be a one-day meeting. And till then, I look forward to a very productive period on our part, where hopefully a lot of things will occur between now and then. And I want to thank you very much again for your participation and wish you all a good day and safe travels back home. Thank you very much.